be here, bringing books to life. Vision without sight.
Elgi and the Galras. Book 1, The Essence Saga Series, by Colin Sinclair. Episode 1. Produced and dramatised by Be Here. They rose, the dark, the keen, and the bright, each to offer words of comfort and solace to hearts that would embrace their message, as they had done each day from the beginning of time. Only now, in amongst the tumult, a different voice could be heard. A voice intermingled with the others. A voice giving a message of inclusion and agreement. It was not possible to see from where the voice came. It had no colour, no light, no dark, and no form. It had not grown from, nor was it interested in, politics, gender, or race. Once, it was a single voice among many, a choice given, a chance to embrace something new, yet as old as the universe itself. It didn't offer power, or riches, or status, yet it held a tone all its own, a promise of equality, fairness, and truth. A vision of eternal peace, harmony, and rest. When heard, its resonance was that of the human soul, and for each new soul that heard the voice, its message became clearer. On that morning, and on every morning thereafter, as it had from the very beginning of time, it spoke. At this time, for humankind, it had become a choice, gaining in volume and intensity.
It was humanity's hope, as it always had been, as it was the hope of all creation. He watched, shifted by the phase in time from the world of humanity, as he had watched for a millennia the conflict that this race seemed to thrive on. At times, he'd been tested to the limits of his ability not to interfere in the lives of humans, the race he had helped to create. He had been sure, on countless occasions, that they would obliterate themselves. But at each stage, the soul's message that he had buried deep within the subconscious had managed to avert complete disaster.
He had wept to see his creation turn from the truth, and he had wept to see them show the spark of understanding that had made all the other life forms in the universe coalesce into a society of caregivers and shepherds of all living things. There was still time, and there was still hope, and at this juncture, it seemed to him that the balance was turning toward understanding. He had never before witnessed a race that had such a fierce independence of soul, that could harbour such love and kindness, yet still accomplish such atrocities. Not ever, in all his limitless lifespan, had he seen such passion and lust for doing evil in the name of good. He reflected on the times he had spent amongst this race as one of them, and how this had felt.
Chapter 1. Elgrid and Chirina. The morning was bright, hot, and a slight breeze eased through the room. Elgrid turned over and slid himself from the bed, conscious that he didn't disturb her as he got up. He walked over to the shutters that opened straight onto the winding streets and opened them. The noise of the day was just beginning to increase in intensity. He could hear the hawkers moving around, pulling their carts and setting up stalls for the day's trade. He stared at the cobbled streets, and as he did, they came alive, the breeze causing the sand to eddy amongst the stones and cracks. Mesmerized by the twisting dance of the sand, he watched, seeing in it the complexity and beauty of life itself. It always astounded and amazed him, the simple way nature took hold and forged its own direction. He waved his hand and removed the invisible barrier that he erected every night to prevent anyone from entering the house, a precautionary measure in such a peaceful city, but a habit he had got used to. It also had the added benefit of stopping the sand but allowing the breeze in, keeping the internal space cool. He stood and breathed in the air, tasting the promised heat of the day mingled with the aromatic spices that filled the narrow streets with their subtle yet alluring aromas. He knew Chirina was behind him, even before she slid her arm up under his and onto his chest. As she pulled herself in, he felt her soft form touch his skin and marvelled at the feel of it. She rested her head on his back and pulled in even closer. He never tired of that feeling. In fact, they had both been amazed at the unexpected joy that touching each other in this human form brought to them. It was an unexpected benefit, indeed, of being in a solid state of reality. He sighed and turned his head to gaze at her. Leaning back and to the side, his lips met hers and they kissed, the soft, soulful kiss of two beings that understood each other inside and out. She disentangled herself from him and walked across the room, turning back with a smile that made his soul leap. She moved through the curtained doorway at the end of the room, and he turned to stare out at the large windows. His eyes scanned the scene in front of him, and his mind turned back to the situation they were in. They had created this situation to get the message to take hold even further, knowing that what they did now would have a massive impact on humanity in the future. They had come close to what was considered direct intervention, which was frowned upon by the few of them that had responsibility for life in the universe. Still, he felt the gamble was worth the risk, and doubted his motives would be questioned. After all, this world and this life form were his creations, and he had nurtured them so far, well within the bounds of allowable intervention. They showed the most promise of any life they had created. Perhaps, as time progressed, they could even find one that would become a part of them, a being that these humans called gods, one with the power to create and destroy all known things. It was his true hope. He turned and followed her through the curtained door and headed for the streets of Mehem. When they had come back to this time, they had found a thriving civilization, but it was also fractured by the greed and wealth that power could bring. Those that could had risen to subjugate others and enslave them to do their bidding. It had taken him and Chirina a few decades to make them begin to see the benefit of a society led by respect and sharing. They had made progress, albeit slowly. To begin with, they had provided what might be considered small miracles to move things in the right direction. Simple things at first, like the ability to build shelter that stood the test of time. Teaching people how to construct and use the natural resources around them. How to divert water to areas that now fed hundreds. Most important was how to grow sustainable food that was plentiful for all. Their hardest task had been to get the people to understand the benefit of working together in numbers. To do this, they had had to give them something to believe in, the glue that forged alliances between people and gave them the desire and direction to collaborate toward the greater good. That something was, for all intents and purposes, a god, a benefactor, but one of the people. They had given him the title of Bremen, and had ensured by the proliferation of stories and writings that he was known and well regarded for his benevolence and love of his people. He ruled over the city where they now resided. They had revealed themselves to his father many decades ago, and it was he who helped them begin to share the message. It was his son that the people knew was Bremen. He was young, bright, and cared deeply for his people. He had gained the people's love, not because he was born a ruler, but because his people trusted and believed in him. He was fair when dispensing justice. He built places of learning open for all. He shared the wealth that was created by improving living conditions and making his people feel safe. Elgrid and Chirina had spent many hours teaching Bremen about how all things were connected and how to utilize the universal essence for good. They had told many stories of creation and of destruction. They had discussed how there was a balance between good and evil, and that both were present always. They had taught him how to share his understanding with the people and create a belief system that would promote harmony. In their discussions, they had warned Bremen of the possibility of others using the understanding for darker purposes, and discussed how he should be watchful. They had slowly told him of their role in the creation of the universe and the hope they had for this planet. Bremen had embraced all possibilities and had become more than even Elgrid and Chirina had hoped, seeming to have an understanding beyond the capacity of his race. As he walked the streets toward the palace, Elgrid hoped that today's discussions would be just as fruitful. He and Chirina were aware there had been a shift in the balance of the essence. They needed to discuss that shift, and then focus their effort on what it might mean. Chapter 2. Framin. Framin lifted his hands from the strands that connected him to the world. He had spent the dark hours following the vibrations and viewing his work across the globe. Each of his followers was connected to him through this web of vibrations, and he could influence them simply through thought. How easy it had been, he mused, to find people that would succumb to his will. He had only to show them the pleasures that could be achieved by connecting with him and the powers they gained from those connections, and they were willing to accept his control. Oh, how simple these people were, so driven by the gain of worldly goods. He was so pleased that they did not understand that all the things he provided them with were a tiny speck of the real benefits they could achieve by embracing the powers wielded by Chirina and her cohort Elgrid. Elgrid's power dwarfed the things that Framin could do. Framin's one advantage was that he did not care about the constraints within which Elgrid worked. He cared not who he upset or what rules he broke. He had already been cast out. His one burning desire was to control all that they created, to turn everything to his will, to regain the power that had been stripped from him. He intended to do this by utilizing the collective strength of the human race, to harness all of their greed and hatred to elevate him back to true power. He leaned back in his throne, a thing of opulence and beauty, designed to awe those that came before him. Fashioned with power from the majestic Grehonaut, a being from a different dimension, one of power, wrath, cruelty, and greed, but able to induce exquisite pleasure at need. When its power was harnessed, it could be used to show those that looked the shape of the thing they most desired but feared, each seeing something different yet magnificent. The rest of the room was adorned with gold and encrusted in fine jewels fashioned into artifacts that took the breath away. Framin had endowed much of these decorative pieces with energy from the universe, which meant their appeal ran deeper than their outward appearance. The walls he had fashioned so that they also appealed at a basic level,
and they changed appearance and colour depending on who was looking at them. In essence, he had created the whole room to be the best possible room any person could imagine. He himself stood as tall as any man, well over 6 feet 5 inches, with shoulders and arms that looked powerful enough to crush bone and rock. His skin presented itself in a burnished bronze colour that almost glistened. His face, high-browed and lean, was breathtaking in its beauty. He was adorned with eyes that were the colour of the clearest sea, shifting between the purest green and the deepest blue. His body rippled with muscles that exuded strength, coursing as he moved in a constant flow that mesmerized the eye. He sighed, a satisfied smile spreading across his face.
"Viana,"
he called, his voice emanating as if in song, irresistible and alluring.
"Viana, bring food, bring drink."
He was hungry and thirsty. It was one of the drawbacks of being in a human form. He could not sustain himself on the energy that the universe provided. It just wasn't enough. And he needed to consume actual food for sustenance. He found he had a liking for some of it. One of his favourites was the local ale. It was earthy and rough and robust, and it sated his thirst whilst leaving him wanting more. A most pleasurable taste indeed. Viana appeared from behind the throne, a line of servants following carrying steaming salvers of fried meats and hot vegetables, sending out smells that pulled him into the present and into the room. The servants placed the salvers on the central table and disappeared, not wishing to be there too long. They knew better than to be there for what happened next. Framin walked toward the table and began to produce a beautiful yet haunting song, woven with discordant tonal notes. As he did, other beings started to coalesce around the table, wisps at first, but hardening as he continued to sing. By the time he had made it to the table, they were all in attendance, his 12 Guarong, humans made strong and given powers from him due to their devout belief in his vision of the future of humankind. 12 beings determined to bend all of humanity to subjugation and rule as servants of the One. He was ready to get them to act. He stood at the head of the table and looked at them all. It was time. Chapter 3. Elgi. The day was bright, the tall grass moving like waves on the ocean, yet softer and more gentle, calming in its nature. From his position on his back, Elgi could see the clear blue sky through the tall grass. His walk from the home he shared with his mother and brothers had been, as usual, uneventful, and had taken him no longer than half an hour. He knew that he had time to spend looking at the sky and envisioning great beasts in the small clouds that floated by. Beasts of great power and strength. He couldn't stay there long, though. He had to collect the mushrooms from the edge of the wood and return home in time for his mother to have them in the stew she was preparing, so that when his brothers returned, there would be food for them to eat. He was the youngest of his family, a slight boy, though he contained a wiry strength. His jet-black hair was shot through with streaks of silver and sat wild on top of his head. No one knew where the silver had come from, and it was of great interest to those in his village because of its unusual nature. Some in the village said that it was a result of the death of his father when he was born. Others said it was because he had been touched by the gods. And others still said it was an omen of dark powers. In any case, he didn't care. He was not concerned with such things. A boy of 16 summers had other things on his mind, and all of them were about the doing of great deeds and strange beasts. He was a daydreamer, and was told so on a daily basis. He closed his eyes and drank in the warm sunshine, listening to the grass rustle as he drifted into his world of beasts and heroes. Something cold and wet on his face brought him back out of his reverie, and he opened his eyes to a hairy face and a long tongue just above his nose.
Akka!
He squealed.
What are you doing here?
The dog barked and jumped back, and then went for his face again.
Stop it! Leave me alone, you great beast!
He laughed and got to his feet. Akka was excited, jumping up and down at him as if to say,
Found you! Where have you been? Where have you been?
Elgie was sure he had left the dog tied up outside the house. But then this dog was able to extract himself from anything and find Elgie. It wasn't that much of a surprise. And, in any case, he was always happy to see him.
Oh, come on then, let's go collect those mushrooms.
He set off at a loping canter towards the edge of the field, the dog nipping around his ankles, to where the trees lay and where he was sure to find the mushrooms and the dappled shade at the edge. He didn't like the forest much. It had a foreboding presence that hung around it. But he was happy to skirt the edges and collect what he could. There were many stories amongst the villagers of people going into the forest never to be seen again. But his mother had told him they were just tales told by the elders to stop children from going in and getting lost on its many winding paths. Still, he didn't like the feel of the place, so there was no danger of him venturing in. He didn't need the tales to stop him from doing that. He slowed as they neared the edge and stretched down his hand to stroke the dog. Feeling for his belt, he undid the small sack he carried with him and pulled it open, ready to put his day's findings in. There was a small bridge he had used to cross the stream that ran around the edge of the field before the wood. When he stepped on it, it creaked and strained at even his insubstantial weight. He wondered at its construction. It seemed to just hang over the water without being anchored anywhere, but it had been like that as long as he could remember. So he wasn't worried about it. He turned to look at his dog, who on every previous visit had refused to cross the bridge and was surprised to see him coming across with him.
You okay, boy?
He asked. Akka turned his head sideways and looked at him as if to say,
Why are you asking me that?
Elgie chortled.
Okay, if you're sure.
Then the dog was off, darting into the woods as if he had been spooked from behind. Elgie stopped, puzzled. His dog had never done that before. Not in all the years they had been coming here. He had never shown any interest at all in going into the woods. In fact, quite the opposite. He looked up and was about to shout the dog's name when he saw a faint glow a little way into the woods. It seemed to be pulsating and coming from one place. It would brighten and then dim. And as he watched from the edge, he noticed that it was increasing in intensity. He could hear Akka barking. Again, unusual. His dog was not a barker. He glanced back and up at the sky and could see that the sun was beginning to lower itself. He must have rested longer than he thought. With a sense somewhere between unease and excitement, he decided to go in after his dog to see for himself what the light was. He still had time. The woods were darker than he thought they would be, but not dark enough to cause any real concern that he might stumble. He pushed on, following the sound of Akka's bark and glimpsing the light between the boles of the trees. In front of him was a clearing, and there, somewhere near the centre of the opening, he saw Akka looking at the ground and digging with his front paws, dirt flying up in all directions.
What is it, boy?
He asked.
What have you found?
He walked towards him, and as he did, the light disappeared. Strange, he thought as he reached his dog. He looked down to see where Akka had been digging, but couldn't see anything other than dirt and leaves. He bent down on one knee and reached out to brush away the dirt and leaves thrown up by his dog. Nothing. Very strange. Where had the light come from? Akka's head tilted to one side again, and he let out a quiet whine, almost like a cry. Elgie felt foolish.
Okay,
he said.
Come on then, let's go. There's nothing here, and I don't want to be here when it gets dark. Come on, Akka.
He turned away, and just as he did, he glimpsed something at the edge of where the dog had been digging. Dropping to his knee, he reached for what he had seen. A stone. Black. As deep as night, and smooth and round and warm to the touch. He had never seen anything like it before. It was as smooth as glass and fit in the palm of his hand as if it were made for him. He turned it around in his hands, moving it about, and as he did, he found himself being drawn into it. But it was just a stone, a different, unusual one, but just a stone. He was about to throw it away and dismiss the whole episode, but he couldn't take his eyes off it. Something made him place it in the sack he used for carrying the mushrooms.
"Let's go,"
he said again.
"We need to get back."
Suddenly, he and Akka were standing just outside his village, his sack full of mushrooms, and the sun had risen in the sky again, as if he had misjudged it when he was near the forest. He looked down at Akka, and the dog looked back as if to say,
"Don't ask me! Don't ask me!"
He reached into his sack and rummaged around to get the stone. Pulling it out, he looked at it again. He began to shake. Something, he thought. It must have something to do with the stone. Confused, disorientated, he heard his mum's voice.
LG!
She was calling.
LG!
Here, Mum.
He called back. He pushed the stone deep into his pocket and started to walk towards the house. He would look at it later. He walked through the village and down the path leading to the door of the small wooden house where they lived. Despite the fact that it was the smallest house in the village and needed some work, it was still his home. He loved the walk to the door, through the vegetable patch where his mum grew most of the food they needed. He could hear the chickens and pigs and goats out back as they rummaged around in the small field they rented from the innkeeper. Well, by rented, he meant his mother paid the innkeeper with fresh meat, vegetables, milk, and eggs that she got from the livestock they owned. They didn't have much money. His mum, Abriana, was a strong woman with jet black hair, a small frame, and a face that was earthy, yet held its own beauty. Abriana could be a difficult woman at times. Their circumstances had dictated it. She'd had to bring up Elgie and his three brothers on her own since their dad's death. She was entitled to be hard. It had been a hard life. But at the same time, she always had time for them all and could be soft and compassionate at need. Still, she brokered no nonsense. Expected them all to do what she bid them to, and expected them all to contribute to the upkeep of the family. His brothers were triplets, all born within an hour of each other, and were 5 years older than him. It had taken his mother 5 years, she always said, to recover from the birth of the triplets. They were already in, all sitting around in the room that passed as the kitchen and their main living room. His brothers were big, round-shouldered, and long-legged. Their faces, though, were always smiling, and they were kind and generous of heart, always teasing him. Despite that, he was sure they loved him. It was a fine family to be part of. It was a happy house. Every day his brothers walked the 2 miles to the edge of the village to be taken by cart to the limestone hill, where they worked digging and cutting stone. The stones they hewed from the rock were massive, and each one was taken away, they were told, to provide for the building of monuments for the gods. Most of the villagers worked in the quarry in some capacity. Each night as they finished, they would leave the stone, and by the time they returned in the morning, the stones were gone. In their place was a stack of gold coins, spices that they needed, and food that they couldn't grow themselves. The foreman and owner of the quarry would share out the payment, keeping a little more for himself as the owner, but ensuring that everyone got their fair share. It was a strange kind of happening, but it had been going on as long as most could remember, and the village had become used to it as part of their daily life. Every now and then, someone would try to stay through the night to see what happened to the stone, but when they tried, No stone was taken, and no payment was received. So, after dark, the quarry was not to be visited by anyone, and was considered out of bounds.
"Have you brought the mushrooms for me?"
his mother asked.
"Yes,"
he answered, and was about to tell her what had happened when something hit the back of his head and fell to the floor. His brothers erupted in laughter and he looked down. A small apple rolled away from him, and his hand shot to his head. "Hey!" he shouted, startled by the sharp pain, and he rubbed the back of his head with his hand. He turned and could see his brothers laughing and smiling at him.
"You should have been back ages ago. Daydreaming again, were you?"
asked Gwiliar.
"No, not daydreaming. Something happened. Something strange."
His brothers laughed, looking at each other and shaking their heads.
"Yeah, we know. You were slaying one of your mythical creatures, no doubt." No, really, something happened."
"Enough,"
came the sharp tone from his mother.
"Now, LG, give me the mushrooms and you free. Leave him alone."
LG passed the bag to his mother and moved off, still rubbing his head, feeling sorry for himself.
"Go and feed the animals, LG, while I finish dinner. Come straight back and get washed up. And you, Free, go and get rid of the day's dirt."
He walked out of the house, still rubbing the back of his head, and made his way to the animals, grumbling as he went. Akka appeared at his side and walked along with him. He rounded the corner of the house, walked into the barn, and sat down on the dried mud. He was certain that the lump on his head was growing at an alarming pace, and he needed to work out a plan to repay his brothers for such a slight. As he sat, the stone in his pocket pushed into his leg. LG stood back up and took it out of his pocket, once again turning it over in his hands and looking at it. Now that he had it somewhere, he could study it more carefully. He noticed that while before it had appeared to be jet black, in reality, it was laced with tiny lines and sparkles that threaded their way through the stone in a lattice. It was most odd. He touched where he thought one of the lines reached the surface and slid his finger along it. And with that, he felt a rush. LG dropped the stone and looked up. He was somewhere else. Chapter 4. Draegar. The inn was the centre of life in the village. Jilin, the innkeeper, had inherited the inn from his father. He had embellished and grown it over the years to the point that it was known by those who travelled the route as a place to visit and receive a warm welcome, with good food and great ale. The inn itself was situated between the two large cities of Mehem and Karba, and as such was used by everyone that travelled the route between them. Jilin, his wife Rianne, and their daughter Ingria were kept busy night and day serving food, cleaning rooms, and looking after the well-being of the patrons. On this afternoon, though, the inn was a little more quiet than usual. Jilin was in a good mood. Trade had been brisk the last week or so, and he thought his wife and daughter could do with a break from their daily routine. He looked around the large room on the other side of the bar to see if he could see them and tell them to go have a rest, but they were nowhere to be seen. As he scanned the room, he noticed one of his regular travellers at a table in the corner. He hadn't seen him come in, but that wasn't unusual. He often just noticed him sitting at a table. Still, it was good to see him returned. He was an odd character and kept to himself, but he always paid in gold and always ate and drank plenty. Jilin could remember the time his father had introduced them when he was a boy, some 25 years past, and Draegar looked no different today than he had that first day. He seemed to be ageless. He always travelled alone, and always carried his stick and nothing else. They had talked from time to time, never about anything of consequence other than sharing news. Draegar was a traveller and had stories from the cities and from further afield. Now that Jilin thought about it, though, he hadn't seen him for quite some time. Perhaps a catch-up was needed, just to see what he knew. Draegar could see Jilin looking at him. and he knew that the innkeeper was coming across to see how he was and what he knew. But there was a problem. Draegar could feel someone close by tugging at the universal lines, and he may need to leave at any minute. Many moons ago, Elgrid had asked him to keep his eye on this village. Elgrid expected that a young boy he had met there called Elgi would have an important role to play in the future of the world, and as such, it was an important job. Draegar knew the village in any case, as it had been his stopover point for centuries. He had seen it grow from a few sparse dwellings into a thriving village. Once he knew that Elgrid wanted the boy watched, he had drawn some energies into the earth around the village and had made sure that calm and positivity was felt by everyone that entered, ensuring, as much as he could, that nothing untoward or unexpected would happen. Just this afternoon, though, he had felt a tug and had transitioned himself to just outside the village. Something had disturbed his energies, and he wasn't sure what it was. He thought it best to be on hand to investigate. Now Jilin was coming across, and he could do without the disturbance in case he needed to leave on short notice. He rose and met him halfway from the bar, extending his hand with a gold coin.
Good to see you, Jilin. How long has it been now? Thanks for the ale and the food, but I must be on my way. Give my regards to the wife and that beautiful daughter of yours.
He backed away, heading for the door before Jilin could answer. He had just stepped outside when he was jolted by a shift in his energy surrounding the village again. This time he knew it was a rift. Someone had moved to another plane. Strange. He had not felt the presence of any of his kind here, or, for that matter, any kind of disturbance in the essence that would indicate any interference. He rounded a corner and settled himself down beside the green space in front of the inn, just out of sight. Closing his eyes, he stretched his thoughts outwards, feeling as he went. He was drawn to the boy's house, the livestock barn to be precise, and he felt the residue of the shift. He scanned the area for the boy, but could not feel any trace of him. That was strange. Where was he? He could feel his essence trail. Something had happened. Something unexpected. And he needed to know what it was. He cast his energies back along the current timeline to the barn and discovered where the boy had been sitting in the mud. Twisting his mental capacity, he followed the essence of the boy's movements backwards through time. Each being in the universe left a trail in the energies they disturbed that lingered for some time before it was absorbed by the whole. This way, he was able to follow the boy back to the woods and the clearing where he had knelt beside the hole dug by his dog. Draegar replayed the scene and saw the boy lift the stone, look at it, and then put it away. How could that be? Draegar knew in an instant what the boy had found. Where had the Galras come from? Had Elgrid placed it there for future need? If he had, Draegar was certain that he would have said something. In any case, he needed to talk to Elgrid about it. If he hadn't placed it there, something, or someone, was playing with their timeline and disturbing a possible future outcome. Draegar stood, twirled his stick in an intricate pattern, and he was gone. Chapter 5. Elgi, Draegar, and the Golras. Nothing. There was nothing, and the weight of nothingness was threatening to crush him. His breath was failing. He felt like his bones were crumbling, and his brain was trying to push out through his ears and escape. He was dying. He knew it, and the weight of that knowledge threatened to crush him even more quickly. Elgi took what he knew was his last breath. As he gasped, he felt the presence of something or someone come into the space, for he could see nothing in the void. The weight had gone, and he was suspended in the nothingness.
It's okay, Elgi,
Draegar said.
I have you. We're safe. I've created an atmosphere around us that will sustain us for as long as we need, which shouldn't be too long.
Elgi was confused. What had happened? Just this morning, he had been leaving to go to the wood, something that he did every day. Now he was with a strange man who he only felt, someone he couldn't see, and was in some place he knew not where. He had come very close to death, and now was being told he was okay. He was not okay.
I am not okay!
He shouted.
I'm not okay! What's happening? Where am I?
Tears began to stream down his cheeks. He began to shake uncontrollably, and on thinking about it, he was sure he had wet his pants. He was not okay. He was not okay at all.
Who are you? Where are you? Where are we?
Dragar snapped his fingers, and a glow began to appear around them, but it did not extend far.
We have to be careful,
Dragar said.
I don't want to upset the equilibrium here by bringing physical matter to the fore.
What are you talking about? Who are you?
Elgi sobbed. Dragar knew he had to do something, and do it now. Coming to this plane of reality when you were prepared was bad enough, but to be cast here without knowledge could be fatal. It was entirely possible that Elgi would lose his mind. He made a decision, and despite the possibility of physical damage, he placed his hand on Elgi's shoulders and shifted them again. This time, they shifted back to the reality Elgi knew, but a place well removed from the village. The place was still very dark, and again, Dragar snapped his fingers, bringing light to the room they had arrived in. Elgi started again and bolted upright, and as he did, something fell to the floor. Dragar bent down and picked up the object.
What is happening to me?
Elgi screamed. He was nearly unhinged. Dragar again put his hand on his shoulder and Elgi collapsed into a heap. He had passed into an induced sleep. Dragar looked back to the Golras. At least he had managed to get it from the boy. He couldn't let him have it back. Not until he knew more about what had happened. He did know, though, that he couldn't keep it from him for long. The Golras would only find its way back to him. If he had managed to use it, it was his for the duration of his life. It was now bound to him. He thought about it for a moment and wondered whether he should reach out for Elgrid. No. At this point, he felt like he could control what was happening. In any case, he was certain that Elgrid would have felt the changes in the essence that had been caused by these events. If he was needed, Elgrid would already be there of his own accord. Elgi felt like he was floating. A soft, gentle voice seemed to be calling to him, and it was soothing in its tone. He didn't seem able to feel his body at all, yet that didn't seem to bother him. He was comfortable, calm, confused, yes, but something felt right deep in the core of his being.
Elgi,
the voice soothed.
Elgi, it's okay. You are safe. I'm with you. Know that no harm can come to you here. I will explain everything to you. You and I are in a safe place. Nothing any stranger than this is going to happen now.
He heard a chuckle.
I suppose in the overall scheme of things, this is about as strange as it gets.
Again a chuckle.
But let me help you. Let me try and tell you what is happening.
His surroundings started to coalesce and he thought he recognised where he was. He seemed to be back in the field of grass, the low sun warming him and the familiar sound of the rustling grass bringing some normality back to his mind.
How are you feeling now?
Elgi managed a few words.
I'm okay. I feel... How did I get back here?
I just wanted to be sure before I start to explain that you're okay. I'm going to be standing beside you in a moment and I don't want it to come as too much of a shock. Are you feeling calm?
Elgi nodded. And then just beside him was the man he had sensed earlier. But this time, the situation didn't feel quite as threatening. He looked at him and realised he had seen him a number of times before at the inn. He remembered Ingrid telling him, when he had asked about him, that he was a traveller. And when he was in the mood to talk, he had news of happenings well beyond the two cities. He also had stories of lands and people no one in the village had ever seen or ventured to. At the time, this had interested Elgi, and he wondered if the man knew of, or had seen any of the people and creatures he had been told about in his stories. In any case, it comforted him to know that he was not a complete stranger. Knowing that seemed to calm him even more.
Okay. So, where should we start? Let me first start by telling you where you are. To keep it as simple as possible, the best way to describe this is that you are asleep, and you are inside your mind, a kind of dream. You seem to have stumbled across something earlier in the day that has led you to these events. Do you remember the stone? It's called a Galras.
LG did indeed remember the stone. Without thinking, he reached for his pocket, but it was no longer there.
I have it. It fell from your pocket and I picked it up for safekeeping. I'll hold on to it for now. Tell me, what do you know about where you live?
I live in the village of Neberil.
Yes, but what else do you know about where you live?
Well, the village is somewhere between the two cities, a many, many weeks' journey from the River of Arl, where there are said to be more great cities. Though no one I know has ever ventured there, and no one that passed through the village has come from those far-off lands.
And what do you know of beyond that river, and beyond what is beyond that?
Elgi thought again.
Once we had a storyteller pass through the village from Carba to the east, and he told tales of a land inhabited by people who were fierce warriors that worshipped a great beast called a Grehenort. He said that this place was across a vast lake, and beyond a range of mountains so tall that the tops reached into the clouds. He was laughed at by nearly everyone, but I always thought that his story sounded real. Then other tellers would preach of men who worshipped a god and travelled far and wide from lands unknown to spread word of his deeds and kindness. I know of Bremen, and how he tells of gods beyond our understanding and reach, gods who watch and benefit us. He says they live in the stars, and that he has been put here to spread their teachings and their ways. I don't understand such things. How can anyone live in the stars?
Dragar was surprised that a boy so young could have assimilated such information and remembered it. It boded well for what he was about to tell him. Perhaps this task would not be as difficult as he first thought.
Let me tell you this. Where we are now is removed from your world in time and in distance. Though I told you that you were asleep, we are really in a different place. We can do this one of two ways. We can talk, and the telling of the truth will take years, though back in your village only seconds will have passed. Or I can show you how to use the Galras. It will reveal knowledge to you as you need it during your life, and we can cover the basics now. Yes, yes, I think that is the best way we will proceed. Here,
said Dragar. He handed the stone back to Elgi.
Be careful not to run your fingers on it, and try not to spin it around in your hand. It will make you feel like you should. That's in its nature. But try to resist and be patient. Listen to what I tell you. Now, I want you to stare into it. At first glance, it seems flawless and black. There are lines and specks in it that are interconnected throughout. Can you see that?
Elgi took the stone and stared into it.
Yes,
he said.
I see lines. And what seems to be little specks moving down the lines and around to others. They are hardly noticeable unless you look really hard. I saw them when I picked the stone out of my pocket in the barn.
Good. That's good,
said Dragar.
Now, roll the stone in your hands and look again.
Elgi did as he was told.
The specks seem to be moving quicker. And they are sparkling a little.
That's it? Yes, that's it. You seem to have the knack. So, what do you know about the stars?
The stars?
Asked Elgi, surprised by the sudden change of direction in the discussion.
Well, they're in the sky.
Yes, but do you know of them?
Asked Dragar.
I'm not sure what you mean.
Elgi thought for a bit.
I've been told many things. Some say that the stars are the souls of the dead, spirits. Some say they are the gods, watching. Some say they are balls of fire, massive and hot.
Well, the last description is closer than all the others, though it's a little more complicated, as all things are. You should know that in reality, everything you see, touch, feel, and even think is part of everything else. So there is some truth in the stories that each star contains either a god or what you would consider the dead.
He chuckled.
Never a simple answer. Always a complication until you understand the whole.
Dragar stopped and chose his next words carefully. He wanted to be as clear as possible about what he was saying.
What you see in the sky as stars are actually other suns, like the one that shines on this world. Other planets surround those suns. There are countless numbers of these in the universe, so many that they are not known by anyone. These are collected into galaxies, and galaxies are collected into clusters. Because there are so many, it means that there is always more than one reality, and therefore more than one timeline. Everything we know is made of energy, and energy makes everything, even you and me, even the stones and the rocks. Then there is time. Time is something that is made up by the sentient beings who have a desire to know their lifespan. It's not a real, tangible thing, but a construct. Then there are planes of reality, like the one we're in now. A different place, but the same, deconstructed from what you perceive as time. The Galras is everything I've explained, but in the form of a stone. What you have to try and understand is that because of the size and the number, all possibilities exist. That includes the everything we know duplicated in multiple places. These stones are rare, however, and controlled by very few beings in the universe. If you utilize the stone in certain ways, you can move yourself from one place to another and from one time frame to another. What we talk of here is complicated. Under usual circumstances, it is saved for scholars and beings who have studied such knowledge for millennia. I know you can't possibly understand it all, but as an idea, I hope you can understand that what you know to be real is just one version of what is possible. All things are possible if you know how to manipulate that which makes up everything.
Elgi stared at the stone in his hand and lifted his head to look at Dragar. He had a million questions, but they seemed so hopeless when he tried to get them out. He spluttered and stopped and spluttered again. Composing himself, he said,
"So you are telling me that I live here, but I also live in the stone, and I also live in everything else. How is that possible? Is that why sometimes in my sleep I see things not of this world, but of the tales I have heard?"
"Well, yes and no,"
replied Dragar.
"Your sleep allows your mind to access that which your conscious does not allow. But because you have no comprehension of what is possible, your conscious does not allow it to be anything but a dream. Without knowledge and training of the possibilities, your mind would unravel and you would return to the essence of the universe. Some humans are more adept at accessing parallel realities, and you seem to have some innate ability in this area. When the Wands created the human race, they put pathways in the minds of all living entities on this planet that could be removed slowly as the race progressed in knowledge and understanding. The hope was, and still is, that these barriers can be erased in some distant future to allow understanding and harmony to prevail across all life here on Earth. We are now at a crossroads in this timeline, and events are unfolding that will lay down a possible future. Whether that future is hope or ruin depends on the human capacity to want to access the right path. Know this, LG. You seem to be mixed up in the unravelling of that future. And from now, your path is with me and those who serve alongside me to ensure the outcome that is desired. It is a dangerous road, and you have been brought to it for a reason I do not yet understand. I can tell you, though, that there is a choice. I can remove you from the path, erase the past and memories of what we have spoken of, and place you back at the moment outside the forest. You would have no knowledge of any of these happenings, and you could continue your life as before. But I think you were brought here for something greater than that. And your chance here is to be bound to the future and do something that is so good it will fill your being with power and love beyond what you can imagine.
Will I get to see Beast?
Asked Elgie.
Will I get to see some of the things which I've dreamt?
Yes, Elgie.
Chuckled Drhaegar.
Yes, you will.
Then I am with you.
The mind of the young, thought Drhaegar. It had a way of prioritizing things that were sometimes lost on those that had been around for centuries. He smiled at the thought and hoped he had done what Elgrid would have expected him to do. He would find out soon enough. He decided that they should go to Meham to talk with Elgrid, and that they would make the journey there by traditional means. This would give him the opportunity to teach Elgi things he thought he should know.